You're listening to a 3CR podcast recorded in the 3CR Community Radio Studio in Melbourne, Australia. If you like what you hear, please consider donating or subscribing so we can keep bringing you more independent community content. For more information, go to 3cr.org.au.
Hi, I'm Kim Salmon. I'd like to have a quick word about public radio, particularly 3CR. The thing about public radio is that it's more open than the more formatted types of radio to what's going on around it. So when you listen to it, you're more likely to hear a reflection of real life. And 3CR, being in the heart of Smith Street, Collingwood, is a particularly good example of what I'm talking about. If you'd like to subscribe, the number is 94198377.
You've been listening.
Those who wish to control their own lives and move beyond existence as mere clients and consumers, those people ride a bike. That's from Wolfgang Sachs.
Well, we know where we're going, but we don't know where we've been, and we know.
Is turning. You're listening to the Yarrabug Radio Show here on Radical Radio 3CR. Podcasting, streaming, or listening on that old transistor in the kitchen. Many thanks to Amy Goodman and Democracy Now!, always a window of insight into what's happening in America. We've got a big show coming up today. We're joined by an overseas guest who's lucky to join us. Marco, good morning. And good morning, Faith. Oh, sorry, microphone's on. We'll do that again. Good morning, Marco.
Good morning.
Good to see you, Faith.
Good morning, Val.
It is a lovely morning here, and actually we're going to have an interesting show about urban design. How to reflect who we are, how do we change it, how do we move.
Mm.
Yeah, big topics. Faith, we're going to get right into it. That lovely moment that took your breath away on a bicycle.
Took my breath away. I had a full-on tantrum. I went for a ride on the weekend. We had planned the weekend before to go bikepacking through the Murchison State Forest, and there was 45 millimetres of rain, so we deferred it, and we went this weekend. So Saturday morning, absolutely stunning winter's morning, rode out of Murchison. Just got onto the gravel, absolutely gorgeous. They, because of all the rain, all the lagoons were full, masses and masses of pobble-bonk frogs going off all the time, birds everywhere, and then my rear tyre sheared itself into two.
No,
I'm not loving
it. So, I don't know, I spent maybe 10, 15 minutes coming up with extreme ways I could still ride 65 kilometres of gravel, but in the end we just walked back to town and got the train back to Melbourne.
Oh. There you go.
So it was like from the sublime to absolute.
Always inappropriate. But sometimes, you know.
It was just what it
you
was.
Lost that zen moment on the bicycle.
Well, 6 months from now you will laugh at it. It was an adventure.
Yeah. I learned there were some learnings to take away from
every time I ride down that road. I'll remember to check my, I actually thought as we were leaving home, because I haven't ridden my bikepacking bike properly for about 6 months, and I thought, should I check the tyres? That side of the tyre is always facing the sun where it's hanging. Nah, it'll be all right.
Preparation. There
we
go. Yeah. Anyway, you got outside. It was lovely. I bet you it was lovely up there.
It was stunning.
Yeah.
All right. As everyone kept saying, best weekend in 6 months.
All right.
Marco, I hope you've got something more uplifting than that.
No pressure.
I do and I don't. So I have two, basically, two short anecdotes.
Do you want
to start with the uplifting? Or the,
I asked the question up. You answer it any way you wish.
Okay, so the uplifting part was this morning coming here to Radical Radio.
Yep.
And finally, after weeks of walking through cities with my family in New Zealand and Australia, finally had a bicycle under my bum again.
Ah.
And somehow life starts making sense again. Like it's, this is what it's all about. So that was really awesome. But a more profound experience I had earlier, and it was actually the first week when we arrived here with my family again, my son of 11, daughter of 13, and my wife, we were cycling through Christchurch, as you do as a Dutch family. My son, being relatively small for a Dutch guy, was on a slightly too big bicycle. And we also put our groceries in his basket. So he was cycling along. We were riding single file. And suddenly a woman turned up next to us, opened her window of her SUV, and shouted first at my son and then at me, "You are a danger." And my son was like, "What is this woman shouting at me?" She's saying that you're a danger. Okay, so that's weird. So next traffic light, red traffic light, I could turn next to her, knock the window. She opened the window. I said, what did you say to us? And she said, "Your son is a danger." And I said, "Please, lady, can you explain to me how my 12-year-old on a bicycle is a danger to you in a 2,000-kilo truck next to him?" And her answer was, "Well, he's wobbling." And then it sort of landed to me. It's like, oh, so it's well-intended, but this is the sign of what we call motor normativity. That while he's wobbling, you are bringing in the danger, but you want to warn us for your danger by turning the tables, right?
Yep.
So that made me realize that actually the cities of the future need to enshrine in their principles that children have the right to wobble.
Yep.
Yes.
To make a quick side step, I used to have in Melbourne, and this was the right cycling that I mostly know, at a red light, I'm in the left-hand lane. There's a right-hand lane. So car behind me, when the lights change, the car behind me is going to try and speed up and get in front of the car on the right-hand lane. You know that. You can feel it behind them.
Hmm.
So my way of coming up with dealing with this was what was called the intended wobble.
Mm-hmm.
I'd take off that split second early as the lights, but I'd behave like it was the first time I was ever on a bicycle.
Yeah, smart strategy. Yeah.
The big wobble, and the car behind me just pulled up straight away. They wouldn't try to speed and rush past you. And it's it. They wouldn't have noticed me unless I wobbled.
Exactly.
You're right.
Yeah.
That's part of it.
Yeah. There's actually studies from Melbourne, very strong studies.
Oh, with the eye movement study.
They found out that if you ask drivers to put cyclists on a scale of humanity, the more gear you wear, so the least human you appear,
subhuman,
you become subhuman. You get on the scale of cockroaches.
Yeah.
And that's not a sort of a very explicit choice, but somehow people indeed... they act very differently around you. We've done studies. Ian Walker in the UK did many studies that if you wear a wig instead of a helmet, for instance, drivers tend to give you more space.
Yeah.
And indeed, if you wobble or if you look new to the game, people tend to see you more as humans and also start behaving more human again.
Yeah.
So let that be the sort of the uplifting part of the story is that, hey, woman saw my son wobbling and she was like, wait a minute, maybe something landed. I don't think so, but maybe something landed when she got home, like, wait a minute.
I need a bigger truck.
Yeah. Why is this kid not in a truck? Can we have trucks for kids?
All right. No. I'll slide into this bike moment quickly, but it'll blend into something else. We'll have to take a break at some stage, but we're all right. Just before I do, I'm not sure if you looked out at the night sky last night towards the west. There's the most stunning waxing crescent moon and Venus.
I did see that.
Doing this slow-mo tango in the western sky over the last couple of days. Absolutely stunning. Anytime you want to feel insignificant as a human, go out and watch that happen. Absolutely stunning.
Yeah, well, in New Zealand, one of the many things that we did was stargazing and seeing the Milky Way and seeing the Southern Cross and everything. It was indeed mesmerizing. And then the Moon and Venus, we saw it yesterday.
Yeah, yeah.
Spectacular.
I wonder if the Dixon Veloway would provide a good view of that, because you're up high above the skyline and the...
Yeah.
You know, heading west.
I don't know. A fair bit of light pollution around that port there, I suppose.
Yeah.
Anyway, the Royal Park's the place to go.
Yeah, Royal Park's always good.
If you're in Melbourne.
Yeah.
Look, back to a quick bike moment. Mark, I work at a place where we refurnish old bikes. It serves a couple of different purposes, but we get a lot of donated bikes, probably from out of people's backyards and stuff like that. But a bike we got a couple of weeks ago was this lovely, all made in Japan. I would have said mid-80s, late 80s, 90s. And it reflects perfectly the environment, or the urban environment, was designed through. Low step through, very small wheels, one gear, little basket at the front.
Mamachari.
Exactly. But absolutely design on it, impeccable. A lovely ivory white with this beautiful red chainstay on it. I rode it home the other day. I've ridden it a couple of times. I've never had more comments from people about the bicycle itself. You could fold it if you wanted to. You'd need a couple of spanners and that. But when I started to look at it again, I thought, this is a perfect reflection of that 1K trip, that 2K trip, a mobility accessory for a dense urban environment. And graceful as well. And actually, you can tell by people looking at it, they get this glint in their eye. Oh, what a funny little bike. I've had the most amazing reactions to it. But then you look at it and you know a designer has followed through. It's made it accessible, easy to use. Everybody can use it. Doesn't take up much space. So it's really a lovely example of actually a bike design reflecting an urban environment.
And the listeners, they don't see you, right? But I see sparkling in your eyes. Yeah, even when you talk about it, it's beautiful. Yeah. I can completely follow this.
Yeah, yeah. Look, it's just one of those things that can draw people to it. But once you look beyond that and look at it, it's simple. It's virtually indestructible. And it serves every purpose, a limited purpose, but a purpose in a dense environment can be that kilometre or 2 kilometre joined up to a transit point or something.
Yeah, and I think you touched something deeper. I don't know if so. You should stop me if we don't have the time for that.
But, no.
For me, it reflects basically what the bicycle can mean or meant. To thinkers in the 60s and 70s in the Netherlands. So the bicycle was a symbol for radical rethinking, and it was exactly because of this. So the Dutch, if anybody wants to learn Dutch, I always try to teach them the following sentence. De fiets is iets en bijna niets. That was sort of the slogan of the counter movement in the 1960s, and it means something like the bicycle is something and nothing at the same time.
Yeah.
Sort of the simplicity of it, the simple means to solve the most challenging problems of society, because it sort of indeed does this. It adds immense additional value for the individual who owns it without taking away value from others, right?
So yeah,
and that is sort of an optimum of a form of mobility. It for instance, it increases your reach incredibly. You actually become a human, is sort of mediocre in the sense of using energy per kilometer in the realm of animals.
Yeah.
But if you put a human on a bicycle, it's sort of there's nothing that it's second to none. So you can actually have much more range through the bicycle. It gives you much more freedom in that sense without taking away freedom of others. And I think that's what makes the bicycle such a magical symbol. That is why we so like to talk about it, not only as a cheaper, faster, easier, healthier means of transport. We all know that. But for me, the bicycle was always, as a researcher and human, interesting because of this sort of symbolic, almost magical thing that lighted up your eyes when you talked about this specific bicycle, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm going to give it back.
Yeah. No, that's one of the other dimensions. It's, so we also work in the Netherlands. So we have seen an emergence of big corporations trying to basically commodify bike repair, right? So you can now rent a bicycle anywhere in the Netherlands as a student, and if you have a flat tire, it's called swap fiets. Mm. You swap it, which makes seemingly sense in a consumer-oriented logic. But we have challenged that, and one way to challenge that is we created for our students at the University of Amsterdam a bike kitchen where they can actually have the exact experience that you had to not only look at their bicycle but feel it, use it, repair it, take care of it, and through that sort of unlock this potential of community, a sense of accomplishment. A sense of real ownership of it.
Yeah.
So we find that actually owning a bicycle might actually be a sort of something that we miss in all kinds of studies where we are like, oh, if more people bike, that's great.
Yeah.
Well, I would say if that means that they're all renting a commodity of a big corporation, that is still not great, right? So I think owning a bicycle has still some value that is under-researched because it actually allows you to do all of this. It actually allows you, if you can fix a chain and you can fix a tire, you basically own the world, right? You're free.
Independent.
Yeah, you're really independent.
Yeah. And it allows you to share it.
As well, yeah, exactly.
It's like music. No one owns... We used to have records. Mm. I'm just realized how old I was. And you'd take them out and physically share them with people and look at them and sit down together and go through the cover and read the notes together.
Or similar to that, I was reading a book on a ferry in Brisbane, like a physical book. And then a guy walked up to me and said, "That is the best book from Game of Thrones. It was the volume 4." And he could only do that because he could see the physical book, right? Yeah. It was not on an e-reader. So there are many of these things, and I think more and more people feel that there's meaning in this, and it's getting it's regaining traction, I would say. And I think the bicycle perfectly fits in that. It's sort of a very, almost fleeting way of. That's what I said earlier, right? My bike moment coming here, it's not just me saying that. I really feel it. Sort of it fits. The bicycle is an extension of me instead. Ivan Illich in the 1970s, the philosopher called this the convivial tool. So the tool actually improves me instead of that I'm handling the tool.
Yeah.
And I really have the feeling that that's something so valuable and so important to a society that has lost almost its reflexivity. I would really advise everybody to see the bicycle as such. Like, take the bike out, even if it's dusty, take it out, do a spin through the city and really enjoy with all your senses, because the moon, the Venus, the eyes, the ears.
And it's that community building.
Oh, man.
All those moments.
And even that you're sharing, right? It's
And it's it's something to build on. That idea is, I mean, when you're talking about the commodification of things like that, those electric bikes will become unrepairable for any home mechanic.
Yeah.
Nobody would be able to, you won't be able to actually.
Oh, there's big news on this, right? So so we were talking about that earlier before the show, if there was news. In the Netherlands, the one of the biggest bike brands, or the owners of the big bike brands, XL, has gone bankrupt last week. And one of the explanations I saw was that they went into the route of making their bikes very integrated.
Yeah.
Like all the parts are integrated, which also makes them unrepairable.
Yep.
And apparently people are feeling that this is not the way to go. So they basically are out of business.
No.
So that, again, is sort of adding this notion. Maybe we should think about bicycles as things that we have a right to repair. To actually, the repairing is great stuff. And then the final point is... to rethink the word sharing, right? Because it's also co-opted by companies like Uber and Lime. These are not shared bikes. These are rental bikes. And the things that we really share that we also feel ownership about.
Data.
I think, yeah.
Sorry. The data, that's what they're buying.
It's data points,
us. Yeah. And we're going to be back just after this.
Yarrabug would like to thank Bicycle Network for their financial support. Bicycle Network, a not-for-profit with 45,000 members, working to get more people riding for their health and well-being. Bicycle Network is proud to sponsor the Yarrabug program and support its important advocacy for safer and more accessible riding. by becoming a Bicycle Network member and or participating in one of their iconic riding events, you're supporting Bicycle Network's Ride to School programs and advocacy campaigns to make it easier for everyone to ride a bike every day. Visit bicyclenetwork.com.au for more information.
It makes sense, right? It's the pattern language.
And you're back listening to the Yarrabug Radio Show with our guest, Marco de Brommelstroet from University of Amsterdam and the lab.
The Lab of Thought.
The Lab of Thought, Utrecht.
The Lab of Thought is located in Utrecht. Yeah, that's where our mega base is.
So we were just, we continue our conversation during the break there. But maybe we should also check in because we were talking about, you know, that sharing and community building and how the bicycle fits in personally and on a social level to all that. But we should maybe check in with your observations on Australia while you've been here and any feedback you have on what you've seen.
Are we really going there? Okay. Okay.
Well, there's going to be a way out, maybe.
No, I learned a thing or two. Also, the last time I was here 3 years ago, is the bicycle has become sort of a tool in a culture war.
Yep.
Which is very unhelpful in having good conversations. And two things that sort of stuck with me from the last time is that we need, one of the things that we need to do much better, those people that think that our cities need to be more human friendly and such, is to talk about the things that really matter to people, right? And that's not the bicycle, it's not the bike lane, so we have, in 15 minutes we went really deep already, so let's keep talking about those things, right?
Yep.
It's not about the bicycle, it is that the bicycle happens to be a means for the autonomy of children, for the
it's a metaphor.
It's for the dignity of life, for many things that people are struggling actually with in their daily lives, and they are now not connecting to the bicycle. That's also what happened in the 70s in the Netherlands, is that many different issues that people felt, they were connected through the bicycle. That happened to be sort of the thing in the middle, the mythical symbol. And I feel that here, so one of the things that happened, for instance, last time was when I went on a radio station in the morning. So I was, I think, three or four radio stations last time. And then you have these people who call in. That's a very Australian thing.
Yep.
And when it was about cycling, it immediately turned into a rant and people were angry. And then the third or the fourth time in the pre-conversation, I said, let's change it and let's ask people the question, could you play cricket on your street when you were a kid? And then can children these days play cricket on the street? And if not, what is happening?
Yeah.
And that actually led to a complete reversal of the emotions. Like people were calling in almost in tears because they realized that something was lost, right? And that's, I think, the key point is we need to keep talking about all these things that we lost in the process instead of saying that the car culture that, where people didn't opt into, they are just living it, feel threatened about if we say we are taking that away. So we need to be better in talking about all the good things that the bicycle can represent, to activate large groups of the population that actually are struggling with all kinds of things that are somehow connected, like even the financial burden of having to own two cars, having to work almost half of the week to pay for the cars that get you to the
work.
To the job work. That you have to work to own the cars.
Yep.
People feel this. People feel that most of, like 60% of the children have mental health problems these days. Parents know this, right? But they are not connecting the dots. So that, I think that's very important. And the second thing is we have to realize that the system around us has been built in the last 70 years, 80 years maybe. Mostly?
Melbourne, probably the last 40 years. About 50 years have been the big, the freeway started.
So in the Netherlands, we are now at the phase, it's about 70 years. Like most of the infrastructure is 70 years old. That happens to be the lifespan of concrete.
Yeah.
So concrete, steel, and asphalt that were the basic layers of this system are now running out of their lifetime, of their lifespan. And we simply do not have the resources to maintain it, to replace it.
Yeah.
So we are going to face in the coming decades for certainty the fact that this system that we take for granted around us simply cannot hold. Like it's unsustainable in the literal term. It cannot sustain. So in 70 years from now, most of what we think and take for granted around us will not be there. So there again, we have two choices. Either this will be a crisis after crisis after crisis, and bridges start collapsing and all these things. Or we're going to use this momentum to combine all these things and say, let's use it as a huge opportunity to build back cities that actually serve us much better. And there we need better stories, right? We need better narratives. We need better signposts for people to understand what we're doing. And that's not a bike lane. Mm. That's not the point. Right? The point is not cars are stupid and bikes are great. No. The point is we feel, and you made that very clear, Val, in the beginning, is we feel that the bicycle somehow is a means that that can help to accomplish these things. So that's why we are very connected to it.
Yeah.
But I think we have to teach ourselves to not, maybe even use it as sort of the forbidden word. Bicycle.
Well, I've never been a cyclist. I've always been a bicyclist. Look, just I know this is one question Australian media are renowned for asking. When you look around those cities that are undergoing big changes, I'm going to say Paris, and I mean, look, I've been watching this. Jane Jacobs tried to stop freeways in New York, the idea of urban design. What are the messages that the best cities are using to get these changes through?
I think I'm a social scientist, and I try to refrain from answering that question. But I think there are some mechanisms that we see, and that's so it's contextualized. That's I think the key thing. So you have to find your own story, your own narrative, because public space and mobility is so complex that there's no one single sort of golden bullet story that is.
Yeah.
That is taking us away from that. Paris managed to get a mandate, like the Anne Hidalgo was re-elected on a mandate, and I think that's one of the key mechanisms, which was not about mobility.
It was
about solidarity, ecology, proximity, and participation. That was the story.
Yeah.
She got re-elected and said that gives me a six-year mandate to create cities that are going to offer the opportunities to have a good life without being dependent on fast mobility. That's where mobility came in. Only then.
Yep.
And that made her allowed her to plant 200,000 trees, create 300 car-free school streets, and most importantly, in the next election cycle, colleague won. But even more important, his competitor didn't even challenge the story anymore.
No.
Because it takes 6 years to so everybody understands. Like, oh yeah, we're not going to bring cars back as we did before. So the only real discussion, political discussion, was the speed of change.
Yeah.
And I think one of the things that I'm very hopeful of is you can use sort of trigger points. And I'm just back from Brisbane. And in Brisbane, they have now six years to prepare for the Olympics.
Yep.
If they do it smart, and I don't know if I trust them, but I think they have the opportunity. I told them, like, if the legacy of the Olympics can be that Brisbane will be the first Australian cities where children from the age of 8 have the right to wobble and have the right to go to school independently, which is basically a United Nations treaty right, which is ratified by Australia as well. If that will be your story, you can use the next 6 years and the Olympics, and then you can become that inspiring city that Paris now is, right?
Yeah.
That's really I think there's no reason that this cannot happen.
No.
And I'm not very hopeful, but there's no reason that it cannot happen. So let's all focus on helping cities to find those narratives that work. And one final thing that's I keep coming back to that. I think focusing on the groups that lost the most helps because and I think it's really it's both the elderly and the children.
Yep.
That are suffering mostly from the fact that we have created mobility systems and streets that do not cater for them, but mostly cater for people going to work.
Yeah.
And again, it's not saying that that's stupid or bad, but we need to sort of show and keep showing that this is the cost. The costs are if you become older and you live in suburbia and you lose your lose your right to drive because of your eyesight or whatever, you're stuck. And that could never have been the goal. And I think if we can connect those dots, again, I have no reason to think that any city in Australia cannot make the shift that we are seeing currently in Paris or elsewhere. So that's hopeful, isn't it?
It is, it is too, Marco. It is really very hopeful.
But we need radical voices, because this change will not come from within the system. That's not how system change works. If we really want the transformation, all come tomorrow to the lecture of Bicycle Network. But also, we all need to help politicians to see this by also bringing in radical voices. So it's so great that there's grassroots movements, that people are going out to be the radicals, because otherwise the moderate voices in politics are considered to be radical. So we need to help them to show that or maybe even to turn it around, the current system is radical, and we need to get back to having much more voices in the conversation.
We need to get back to being able to kick a footy and play cricket in the street, and that would be a good reflection that the street is safe.
Excellent.
And on that note,
just a reminder that coming up tomorrow evening at Bicycle Network, you can hear Marco talking more on this topic. And I'll pop a link in the podcast when it goes online. But if you Google Bicycle Network and Marco to Brommelstroet, then you'll find a link.
Good luck writing my last name.
And that's all we have time for today.
And coming up next, I think, is Lost in Science. I'm not too sure, but we'll be back in a couple of weeks.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast. If you found it valuable, please consider donating or subscribing to support independent community radio. To find out more, go to 3cr.org.au.